CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 113 with Dr. Ken Nischel, what you absolutely must know about pediatric cataract surgery. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, the sweetest ophthalmologist I've ever met in my entire life. That is Dr. Ken Nischel, a pediatric ophthalmologist who's pioneered a lot of things like pediatric corneal transplants. I learned how to do baby lensectomy from all your tricks and tips. And I just love hanging out with you. We had a great time together in London for the Ridley 75th anniversary. It confirms what I know, that anyone who works with kids is on the medical side, you're a sweetheart.
I don't know about that, but I love working with kids. I really do. I've always loved working with kids.
Now tell us, how did we get so lucky to recruit you to the U.S.? You basically built the pediatric ophthalmology for business unit at the Great Ormond Children's Hospital in London.
Well, yeah, so to be fair, the pediatric ophthalmology and strabismus was already very well established at Great Ormond Street Hospital Children. You know, it had a long tradition. David Wybar had been there, then David Taylor, Isabel Russell Eggett. And then when I got there in 1999, I'd just been in Toronto. I did my fellowship in Toronto, and I'd seen all these kids with congenital corneal opacities who were getting, you know, reasonably good results with David Rootman doing corneal surgery. And I'd had very good training as a senior. I was an old senior registrar. My training was the old style training in England, where it wasn't a run through. You know, you did two or three years as a senior house officer, then you had to get a job as a registrar, then you got a job as a senior registrar, and then you became a consultant. So during that time, I think I had done, you know, thousands of cataracts. I'd done about 52 corneal transplants.
Wow.
As a registrar and a senior registrar. I'd worked with Tony Braun, who was a very famous cornea person, you know. And so when I went to Toronto and I saw what Dave Rootman was doing, what I did was, in my research time, I would go to Dave Rootman's clinics in his office. Because the main thing about pediatric cornea and cataract is it's not the surgery itself. It's the how you manage the children afterwards.
Right.
So I was lucky enough to learn that. And when I went back to Great Ormond Street, Shiraz Dyer, who was in London, great friend and a great supporter, he said, Ken, you need to do this. And if you have a complication, I can come in and help you, but you need to start doing this. So with his encouragement, I started doing this pediatric cornea, and I established the pediatric cornea network, if you like, in the United Kingdom. But what basically happened was I used to live outside London. You know, like how people live in New Jersey and go into Manhattan in New York. Right. And the commute was terrible. Like, it could sometimes take 3 or 4 hours a day.
Wow.
And the problem was, in London, when you work in the National Health Service, you're employed part-time. So I was employed 3 days a week. And my salary didn't cover the salary of my two private secretaries.
Oh, why?
Whoa. So in order to make a living to look after your family, you have to do private work.
Okay.
So I was basically working 6 days a week. And Sundays in the morning, my fellows would come to my house outside of London to do research between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And I would get them breakfast. And then I would see my kids on a Sunday. And just one day, I mean, I don't know if you want to hear the exact story of what happened. I was running late. And Great Ormond Street there's Great Ormond Street on one side, Guildford Street on the other side, and they're connected by something called Lamb's Conduit Street.
Okay.
And I'm running around Guildford Street onto Lamb's Conduit Street, and I ran into a homeless person who was on the corner, but I didn't see him. And my knee hit his face, and he was bleeding. Oh, and I'm like apologizing, you know, I dropped my stuff and I wrecked him. And he looked at me and he said, you know, this place is not going to stop when you die.
Oh.
And there was this moment.
Right.
And I thought, oh my goodness, the only people who are actually going to care if I'm not here are my kids and my wife.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Right. So that day I went home and I remember sitting with my wife and saying, this is not the kind of life we wanted, is it? And she said, well, the kids don't see much of you, really. Mm. You know, because I would leave early, come home late. And basically, I have a great, I had a great mentor. He's a great friend of mine now, Alex Levin. And I rang him and I said, look, I'm thinking about what I'm doing. And he said, do you mind if I let people know that you're thinking about moving? And well, before I knew it, I was getting job offers from all over the place.
Right, of course.
And what basically happened was that Joel Schumann was the chair at Pittsburgh.
Right.
And he phoned me. And he was so nice. Yeah. He just said, look, you know, it would be amazing if you came. Why didn't you come and visit us? And I went, okay. And in fact, Paul Phillips is a very good friend of mine and is now the chair at Arkansas Children's Hospital in Little Rock. He was the one who had first said to me, look, come. So I went to I went to visit Little Rock. And on the way back, I went to Pittsburgh. And again, I'll tell you something that's really, I'm a little, I'm not sure if it's because I'm an Indian background, but sure. I, you know, I look out for signs sometimes. I don't look for them. When something happens, I'm like, that's weird. Right. So I had a sister called Tito who unfortunately passed away in 2010. And I'm in Pittsburgh and I've been there for, I was there for a day. I'm flying back. I'm going back out to the airport. And the guy who picked me up, he said, oh, I'm going to take you through downtown to show you bits of downtown. And he takes me onto this road. And the road's name is Tito's Way.
Oh, wow.
He's like, oh, my God, this is a sign.
Yeah, this is a sign.
Yeah. And then I met Chris Gessner, who was the president of the Children's Hospital. And he said something that really struck me. He said, Ken, we're never going to be as big as Great Ormond Street or as Children's Hospital of Philadelphia or as Toronto, but we can be more impactful. And I really like that.
Right, of course.
Yeah, so that was it. And then I asked for development seed money to really build a world-class pediatric ophthalmology service. And they gave it to me. So they built a whole new clinic for me. You know, we were the first children's hospital in the world to get the integrated intraoperative OCT.
Oh, wow.
We got it before the adults got it, like in 2015.
Oh, you're really, yeah, very far. You got that 10 years ago. You were like one of the pioneers.
We were. And then they, Zeiss asked me to help show what its uses could be in pediatric anterior segment. And that's how I'm here and I've stayed here. Pittsburgh is the most un-American American city. You know, it's hilly. It's got its little neighborhoods. The streets are not parallel. It's not really a grid system. And it's got a very, you know, European feel to it.
Yeah, I know. I think you've been there now, what, a dozen, 15 years?
Coming up to 15, yeah. 14 so far.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, you've had an incredible impact. I mean, I first learned of you because I was teaching residents, UCLA residents, the county hospital. We didn't have any pediatric ophthalmology fellows at all. So we were just like, me and the resident, we had to do it together. We got to do the pediatric cases. And your technique of two incision push-pull was like genius. So if you don't know, our audience may not know, please explain, what is two incision push-pull? It's like completely changed pediatric lensectomy.
So, you know, basically what happened was that I remember I was a junior trainee and I'm assisting a very, very famous cataract surgeon. I won't say who it is because I didn't tell him I would take his name. And he's doing a pediatric case and he starts, you know, with the uterator forceps at the center. And as he's doing it, it just gets bigger and bigger. And he's right. Like, oh my goodness me. And I remember him saying, you know, he said the pediatric capsule is so elastic that you have to keep trying to pull it in all the time. And it's not always easy to keep control of it. So that stuck in my mind. And I was like, my goodness. So does that mean that your learning curve is going to affect a child? Because as you know, children rub their eyes, they trampoline the anterior chamber. So if your anterior opening is bigger than your optic diameter, then there's a chance that the lens will move forward
right.
And you get lens iris capture and all the problems that that comes with, especially if you've got a whole lifetime to go through. So I read a paper by Apple and Kent, okay. where what they had done was in a porcine eye, which is the capsule of a pig eye, is very much like a child's, it's very elastic, where what they did was make a stab, grab it, and they pushed it and then pulled back. Mm. And they said that you could get orexis. So again, you know, you need good mentors, right? And when I was a fellow, I was with Alex Levin doing a pediatric case. I said, listen, Alex, I read about this. And since we're doing a lenzectomy, so we're not going to put an implant in, can I see if this works? He went, sure. So I did the stab. I pushed. And when I went to pull, it just exploded. And then I had to do the lenzectomy. And so it didn't make any difference because we still had capsular support. So I went away to the drawing board. And then I thought, oh, look, if I make two stabs, and I push and I pull, if it's elastic enough, and because the curvature is there, you can never flatten the baby's curvature unless you're using it on five. I have no financial interest in that, but something really heavy, right? That way, I'll be able to get a orexis. So the next time, I said to Alex, I've got this modification. He goes, I hope it's better than the last one. And I did it, and it worked.
Wow.
And I remember looking at him and he's looking at me. He went, oh, that worked. So what we found was with time, the older you are, the less round the rexus is. So you actually have to do, you make your two stabs. Okay. And the idea is the two stabs are the diameter or just a little bit under the diameter that you want. And you then, in the older children, you have to, you push to one side, push to the other side, so you've got a tear here, and then the same on the other side. And then when you finish one side, you just include the initial stab so that there's no weak point.
Right.
And then you can finish the other stab tear. And these are robust. And what I say to people that I speak to around the world, most people have an idea of how they want to do the anti-orexis, so that's fine. But where this technique really comes into its own is when you do the posterior axis.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do the two incision push pull posterior axis, it becomes so much easier because it's smaller than your anterior one. You make your two stabs, tamponade the vitreous, push pull, and you're done. And yeah. My fellows, when they first come to me, they don't do the anterior axis first. I make them do the posterior axis.
Sure.
It's psychological, right? They've been taught in their whole residency not to touch the posterior capsule. And now I'm saying stick an MVR blade.
You're right. That's really neat. We'll have to feature a video on this. When we air your podcast, the day after, yeah. I'll have a video from you. We'll put it on Cataract Coach.
I'll send that to you. No problems. Yeah, and what I say to people is, look, you're using the two stabs as a guide to the size so that the optic is captured nicely by the anterior opening. If you want to modify it, go ahead and modify it. You don't have to do it exactly the way I described it. That's the beauty of surgical techniques, right? They evolve. And I think that's what I love about our profession is the evolution of ideas.
Yeah, for sure. Now, let's talk about if you have a one-month-old baby, first month of life, you're doing a pediatric lenzectomy because the baby has a congenital cataract. What size are you aiming for that, your two-incision push-pull rexus?
I normally make it about, to put this into context, most babies who have a unilateral cataract have some form of PFV, right?
Okay.
That's the commonest cause of a unilateral cataract. They don't do well at 1 month of age with an implant. So I'm going to try and make it as large as possible because I don't want it to go into phimosis, but I want enough support. So I will probably make that about 6 or 7 millimeters.
That's a pretty large size then.
Yeah, because I'm not going to put an implant in on that day. Because now, if you have a child who has, so this is a really important point. I'm glad you've raised it. You know, I have most of the people who did the IAT study, the infant aphakia treatment study, are good friends of mine. And they're honest, brilliant surgeons, brilliant scientists, but you know, a lot of the colleagues from around the world had issues with some of the recommendations from that study.
Yes.
And the reason is that study was a unilateral cataract study, right? And okay. The majority of children with unilateral cataract have PFD. And I agree that implants at a very early age don't necessarily do well with them because they have leaky vessels, etc. Now, if you have a child who's got bilateral cataracts and the eye size is normal, I'm looking to implant that child normally around anything from 7 to 8 weeks of age.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, the reason why I do that is because for two reasons. Number one, if the eye is normal and you've got a crystalline gene mutation or a connexin gene mutation, the eye's normal. There's nothing else going on here. And right. As long as you do the critical part in a child under the age of 5 is the anterior vitrectomy.
Okay.
And what I find is people do an anterior vitrectomy by just doing it in the middle. Well, that's not where the problem is. The problem is once you've done your posterior orexis, the hyoid face is hugging that the remaining of the posterior capsule.
For sure.
So when you go in with your vitrector, you do it in the center for sure, but then with the face down, you want to hug the posterior capsule on the underside and then take away that vitreous for 360 degrees
all
the way around. Because that's where the scaffold occurs. If you think about lens epithelial cells that grow across,
right.
Well, if there is a gutter there that you've created, they'll fall right in it.
They'll go right in it.
Exactly. But if you don't do that, then you've got vitreous that collapses forward, and that's how it grows across. So I think surgical technique is important. I wouldn't encourage anyone to put an implant in an infant unless they've done, you know, at least 50 or 60 children. And for example, I have a great colleague who was my fellow, and she then became a colleague because she was so good, we offered her a position. But over the last 3 years, I've sort of introduced her to younger and younger and younger children, where for the first time she did a 4-month-old all by herself, no problems, but she's gained that confidence.
Right.
What you can't do is, having done, you know, 10 pediatric cataracts in your fellowship and maybe 400 in your residency, if you were lucky, to jump into an infant cataract surgery with an implant.
Yeah.
You're much safer. Go ahead, leave the child aphakic, leave enough room, and then go in and put a secondary implant in if you need to, because some kids will be fine with the contact lens. So going back to that 1-month-old, I would do a big opening, make sure the lens aspiration is done. And other, you know, the most important thing, lens capsule polishing.
Of course.
We don't do that enough.
Yeah.
You know, if you polish that lens and go all the way to the equator, you see less phimosis, you see less fibrotic change, and the kids have a really nice, quiet eye.
Of course.
So that
applies to adults even. I polish every adult.
There was a very famous adult surgeon in the Philippines who's passed away now, and his name escapes me, but he was, you know, first time I met him was 20 years ago, and he was close to retirement at that stage. But he did this great talk where he'd done like something like 20,000 cataracts, and he showed where when he started doing lens polishing that his rate of YAG capsulotomy dropped to less than 0.1%. Before he did lens capsule polishing, he had a rate of 20 to 25%.
Right, very typical.
But you know what? When you're a young surgeon, you're just glad that you didn't drop the nucleus. You just want to get that implanted.
No, no, for sure. So let me go back to this again. So because in other parts of the world, cataract coach is totally worldwide. I mean,
yeah.
Literally 100 countries or more listen to cataract coach stuff. So if you're a very experienced like you, pediatric ophthalmologist, and you've done countless numbers of these baby lensectomies, you'll then, after the posterior axis, go in with a small gauge, 25 gauge retractor, and the cutter port facing posterior towards the optic nerve, go under the capsule 360 and clean up all that vitreous.
Yes, you have to.
Okay, and then...
And that you need to take your time to do that, and then do your, you know, vitrectomy in the middle, for, you know, a good... a vitrectomy. And my fellows always say, how much do you do? I said, you know what, if you're in there and you count to 60 seconds, that's what you need to do. Yeah. I see people do it kind of like a blah, 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 and I'm done. And I'm like,
no chance. Yeah.
No, it's all going to come forward again. So I think that's really important. The other thing that's really important is I use preservative-free dexamethasone.
Oh, yeah, nice.
0.2 mils, which is 2 milligrams. And I've published about this. People said, oh, you know, the pressure will go up. None of our cases, the pressures went up. But here's the kicker. We did not, and we do not, get any membranes first 2 days post-op.
Oh, nice.
This doesn't happen.
Right, because the baby inflammatory response is so much.
It is. And the other thing was, there was a paper done, gosh, in the 1980s that showed in children, if you don't close the wounds tightly,
right,
your chances of a fibrinous reaction are higher. Now, I don't know why, but it clearly showed that. And David Taylor, when I got in at Great Ormond Street, an amazing surgeon, he said to me, I had a child who had a fibrinous reaction. He said, Ken, you didn't close the sutures tight enough. You have to close them tight. And of course, for us here, in most parts of the world, you can get tenovicral, which is absorbable. Yeah. And if you can't, and you have to use nylon, well, you do nylon, and then you give the child mild sedation to remove the sutures.
Yeah, no, for sure. I learned that too. I learned pediatric lumpectomy from one of your colleagues, your friend, Federico Velez, here in LA.
Yes.
He's a great guy. Yeah, back in 2004, we had just received at our teaching hospital the brand new 25-gauge retractor system.
Yes.
And that's when I said to Federico, can we try this for a baby lumpectomy? Why should we do 20 gauge? This is 25. Yeah. And so he did. Yeah. So he's the one who taught me. Yeah, close the even the scissors are tiny.
Yeah.
Even if it's paralysis, if it's a 1 millimeter incision, you must close it with a suture.
Yeah.
We used, like you said, tenovicral and made it absolutely watertight.
You know, I can explain to you why that's necessary. I mean, so it turns out I was very lucky. I was asked to give the Husted Memorial Lecture at Johns Hopkins at their Anesthesia Society.
Okay.
And the one of the things that I have that is a big bugbear for me is I think children should have paralysis when they have surgery, because I don't want to use a traction suture, because the younger the child, when you use a traction suture, you're indenting the vitreous base. And I don't want to do that.
Sure.
Right? That's the first thing. The second thing is I don't want the eye rolling up when I'm trying to close the suture mm-hmm. the eye closed. So they get paralysis. Then their end tidal CO2 needs to be as close to 30 as is safe for the child, according to anesthesia. And the reason is this. We're just about to publish this work. We used our integrated intraoperative OCT to measure the choroidal thickness and the intraocular pressure with an ophthalmodynamometer.
Okay.
While we change their end tidal CO2. And when you're at 50, your choroid is really thick and your pressures are anything from 30 to 40.
Oh.
You go down to 40, the pressures are in the 20s and the choroid gets thinner. Go down to 30 and your pressure is less than 10.
Oh, well, I had no idea.
Well, that's right. We're going to publish this because I think this will make a difference to adult surgery as well. I'll tell you why. The older you get and you have peripheral vascular disease, your ability to auto-regulate goes out the window.
Yeah.
So when you hold your breath because you're frightened, your oxygen, your CO2 goes up. As your CO2 goes up, your choroid gets fatter.
Yeah.
As your choroid gets fatter, you get positive pressure. So when you're operating, getting positive pressure, we're going to say to the adult world, hey, just stop, get them to hyperventilate. And you'll actually see everything sit back.
Yeah. Hyperventilate, drive down the CO2, the cord will get thinner, the pressure gets lower.
Yeah.
Oh, that I never even thought of this. It was never even on my radar.
Yeah, but we're going to pop this paper. It's just being written now. It's done by anesthesia and myself and my colleagues. It should be submitted in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And we're looking for a very high impact journal because I think this is really important for the whole operating world to know, not just pediatrics, right?
Yeah. And
so the other thing is, when I was studying for this talk that I gave, I was looking at the composition of adult sclera versus child sclera.
Okay.
And there is a glycosaminoglycans that is very highly present in adult sclera that is not present in children's sclera. Like it's 0.1% as opposed to 60%. And it is the same glycosaminoglycans that is in cartilage.
Oh,
so you have a glycosaminoglycans that is so stiff that it's in cartilage, and the same glycosaminoglycans is expressed very heavily as you become an adult, which is why your sclera is stiff.
Yeah.
But when you don't have it, your sclera is floppy.
Yeah.
So when you make a 1 millimeter incision, the movement of the lids causes the wound to fish mouth, even though it's 1 millimeter.
Oh, well, yeah, even if it's a 1 millimeter paracentesis.
It's going to fish mouth, and that fish mouthing can cause stuff to go in. You can get a fibrinous reaction, or the AC can shallow.
Wow. So now, if you're doing this little, you know, neonate, and you're putting an IOL in, let's say.
Yeah.
Where are you making the incision? How are you making the incision? How are you closing it? How wide is the incision? What type of lens? What type of lens? And what do you aim for refractive outcome?
Okay. So my that's a great question. So, but it is very patient. You know, we talk about personalized medicine, right? Okay. This is the most personalized medicine you can get in ophthalmology. I mean, I know the adult surgeons are looking at at constants and the A constants and personalizing right. them, but this is truly personalized medicine. Let me give you an example. So let's say I'm dealing with a 3-month-old who has bilateral cataracts, okay? And I'm going to do both eyes, but I'm doing one eye first and the other eye a week later, something like that, all right? I always make my incision temporally. Okay. And the reason why I make it temporally is this. When you make an incision superiorly and you put your lens in, there's a moment where the eye moves away from you and you can no longer see the leading haptic clearly.
Okay.
Because I do everything from the front. So I open, take out the lens material, open the back. I want to see the leading haptic all the time because I don't want by accident to pop it through the posterior opening.
Right.
Now, if you don't do that, if you close the eye and then do it through the pars plicata or you do it underneath the lens, then it doesn't matter where you do it from. But I have clear reasonings as to why I want to do it from the temporal side. And then the other thing is I do it just where the blood vessels are coming into the cornea. So it's not totally clear cornea, but it's not limbus. You know, it's not sclera.
You have to hit the vessels. A little bit of bleeding means it'll seal well.
That's the trick. So I do that, and then why do I do that? If you're operating on an infant, the chances of glaucoma are higher than if you're operating on a toddler or a child who's older. If I violate the conjunctiva, studies done in Moorfields in the 80s and 90s showed that violation of the conjunctiva means that you get an increased fibroblast response, which means that any drainage procedure fails faster.
Oh, for sure. Of course.
So, you know, almost clear cornea, temporal incision. And then, of course, you have to close it with Vicryl.
What's the incision width and what's the tunnel length of the incision?
The tunnel length, I would say, is a millimeter. So I go perpendicular down. Yeah, short. Short. Okay. The trouble is if you shelve it too much in children, it goes white. You get a scarring response.
Okay, so a little shorter incision.
Yeah, so I tell my fellows, I go, when you enter the first time with the MVR blade, you enter perpendicularly. As soon as you see the tip in the anterior chamber, you flatten your hand.
Okay.
So it is like, you know, less than a millimeter length. And everything initially is done with two MVR incisions.
Right.
So I do bimanual irrigation aspiration. Now here's the other thing that I do. In children, the chances of you having a posterior capsular deficit are higher than adults.
Okay.
Especially if you've got a white cataract. Now, because that's the case, if you take the nucleus out first and you've got a defect, now you've still got the peripheral lens matter and you're trying to remove that and you could be tugging on vitreous. Okay. And that's when you can cause detachments, right?
Sure.
So what I do is I remove the peripheral lens matter first.
Oh.
And then remove the nucleus last. And so that my fellows get used to that. I have a very simple idiom, which is, if you want to do the difficult cases well, you do what you do in the difficult cases in the simple ones. So when you can see that the capsule's intact, I make my fellows and I myself always remove the peripheral lens matter first and then the nuclear plug last.
Oh, so very, I didn't even think of that.
So when you have a completely wide cataract, when you do that and you take the plug out last, if you've got a deficit, you're safe because the lens is clean pretty much. And now whatever you want to do, you know, when you do your vitrectomy, you can clear up the tidy up the posterior opening. Now, I sometimes will convert that posterior defect into a rexus by doing a two-incision push-pull either side.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. The other thing that the two-incision push-pull is good at, and it's, as you know, they, it's nice when other people take your technique and show that it can work in different circumstances. And there was a group in India that said, if you have a plaque on the posterior capsule, if you do the two-incision stab at the edge of each side of the plaque, put your tamponade in, and then just push and pull, the tear follows the plaque as a template.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
That hadn't even occurred to me. And then they published that. And, you know, as you know, it's a nice feeling when people, again, there's an evolution of what you've described.
I don't know for sure. So how wide is your incision? So you're going to start off the case. You want like two pairs of teeth about 180 degrees apart. You'll do
about 120. Yeah.
Okay. You'll do a 23 or 25 gauge to remove the lens, do the vitrectomy, then. And then when it's time to put the lens in, you're going to make a new incision now temporally.
So how wide? So where I entered temporally, right. I just enlarge that and I do 4 millimeters. No, 3 millimeters. Sorry, 3 millimeters.
And you're putting in a three-piece lens then?
I am putting in a three-piece lens. Let me explain why again.
Okay.
In children, the chance of you putting in a three-piece lens and finding suddenly that something happens to the posterior capsule because it's not particularly, you know, it wasn't particularly robust. Is higher than an adult.
Sure.
Now, at that point, you've got a lens in the eye and you can't put it in the bag now. You've got to put it in the sulcus. If I put a one piece in, I got to pull that out with all the trauma of the iris.
Yep, for sure. So you put the three-piece lens in it, and how are you putting it? Haptics in the...
So I usually put haptics in the bag and the optic in the bag, but I've recently gone to doing posterior optic capture. And the reason why I've done that is that I found, so I am moving to the idea of EDOF lenses in children.
Oh, and, interesting.
Yeah, and I find that you don't want them to decenter. So the best way to stop a lens decentering is to do posterior optic capture. Right. And it doesn't decenter. So I'm early days. I don't have enough follow-up to talk about it, but even if you use a toric lens in a child, I think you have to do optic capture to stop that lens rotating.
So you're having, for your typical one, let's say you're doing a monofocal lens in this little baby, you're going to put in haptics of a three-piece lens in the sulcus, in the bag.
Yeah.
And then the optic behind the posterior rexus.
Not always, sometimes. I've been moving to do that. So people listening to this who worked with me will know that I usually just put it in the bag. But in the last, I'd say, year, I've been moving to do posterior optic capture because I think the visual axis remains clearer.
And what are you aiming for, let's say, in this 2, 3, 4 month old for refractive outcome? Your goal is what?
So there used to be this rule of sevens, right? That you take the age of the child away from seven and you give them that. But so if you use the rules of seven, you'd be aiming for +6.5 or a +7. It's not enough. You need to put in a +10. So I have this sort of augmented. So it's in the first 3 months, it's allowed +10, and then it drops down to +8. By the time they're one, it's down to +4, and then it sort of goes down by half a diopter every year. I always leave it +0.5, even until the age of about 10.
Interesting. And now you were saying typically you're doing monofocal, but now you're doing a little bit of EDOF lens, extended up the focus.
Yeah, but in my older children, I'm using it in children over the age of 11 or 12. You know, I always do it in those that age group first and then move down. The problem of using any sort of diffractive multifocal in younger children is that it, we know it affects your contrast sensitivity. And amblyopia gives you a contrast sensitivity problem. I don't want the two to sort of make work together to make things worse for the child.
Well, in the U.S., I think the only there are only a couple EDOF. One would be the Alcon Vivity.
Yes, that's the one.
So, but then even that one does cause a little contrast loss. A little.
So, you know, yes, I've read about that, but I kind of felt compared to a diffractive, it's much less.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
for
and sure. It's just the teenagers, you know, I've had teenagers now, like, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, parents coming in and saying, would you consider using a multifocal? And then I tell them why not. But I've been to this meeting in Zimbabwe, actually, where there were international people there. And some of them were using EDOFs in teenagers and describing in their talks good results with, you know, minimal contrast issues. So I thought it was worth trying.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I had a case on cataract coach where I had a patient who was 16 years old, pretty big kid. Actually, he's bigger than me. He's probably 6 foot tall, 200 pounds, big kid. He had, for whatever reason, bilateral PSC cataracts, like really bad, to the point he's 20 out of 200, posterior subcapsular. But otherwise, totally healthy, normal kid who has never had cataracts his whole life, has been a plano patient his whole life, emmetropic. Now, what lens do you put for him? To me, I ended up going with trifocal IOLs because he just didn't want to have any kind of reading glasses. He's not going to wear them.
I mean, you know, when you got a 16-year-old kid, it's pretty much an adult, right?
Yeah.
But I think that if you explain to them what the downsides of a trifocal are, and I have not used one, so you would know much better, and explain what the upsides are, then I think that's fine. I mean, you know, even so, you know, here's the big thing. I often get parents bringing me children from out of state where the child has a lamellar cataract, right? And the local doctor saying, well, the vision's 20/30, we don't have to operate. But then you do a glare test and the vision drops to 20/80.
Yeah.
And the child is saying, and the parents are saying, he just looks like he can't see when we go out, you know?
Right.
So you have to explain to the parents, look, we'll operate, but you understand that he's going to lose his accommodative ability, that he's going to have to wear bifocal contact lenses or glasses. Those are the ones, you know, if they're under the age of like 8, I'd go for a monofocal still. I don't try and convince them otherwise. But I'm hoping that with some of the results that are coming out with the EDOFs that maybe we will consider using them in younger children.
Yeah, I think there's an advantage. I mean, obviously with the EDOF, you have a larger landing strip, if you will, because the range is 1.5 diopters, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah. I think that range is enough for them, you know. And if you say, look, if you're going to be working for a long time, it's important that you, you know, you have some reading glasses because it could get a bit difficult. But I think the other thing also is that, you know, again, people talk to me about light adjustable lenses. They say, oh, can you not put an LAL in so that as the child gets older, you can change it? I said, well, the problem is that you've got all these fibrotic changes of the capsule sometimes. And then if you've got a light adjustable lens, the light's not going to get through that fibrous capsule.
Yeah.
And now you're going to get all sorts of weird changes. So I think that we just have, I think by doing the posterior optic capture in these lenses, you get the anterior and posterior capsules to fuse, right, but you've got a really nice big opening because the optic is keeping everything open.
Yeah, sure.
So do you do optic capture?
Yeah, we do it a lot. I mean, we do a lot. And then obviously the beauty there is it keeps the IOL perfectly centered.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty there.
And the other thing is, in fact, I have a fellow at the moment, a research fellow writing this up. I'm writing my experience of aniridia cataracts.
Oh, interesting.
And I have some very interesting cases where in one eye, I put it in the bag and they come to the other eye. And the anterior capsule was really weird. I've got some really nice images of how the anterior capsule in aniridia is not normal. And it's not normal because PAC6 is expressed in lens epithelial cells that you know, lay down the capsule. And so the anterior capsule sort of tore. So I had to do a posterior optic capture. the difference in how quiet the eyes look. There's no cellular activity,
right?
But both the eye with the capture looks so clean, and the other one has got all these lens epithelial cells growing.
Yeah, right,
it's really dramatic.
For sure. Yeah, no, I think that's a smart way of doing it for these kids. And then for me, with this kid, the kid that I did, the 16-year-old, I ended up seeing him a few years later. He had shipped a little myopic, so we just did his LASIK once he kind of evened out and stopped changing.
Perfect.
So you know, pretty easy.
Other thing that I found is the children who have lens capsule polishing have, and this is anecdotal at the moment, I've got to look at the numbers, but anecdotally, they have less myopic shift than the ones who have not had that done. You know, and yeah, where the capsule is very thick and white.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Because yeah, if you get a little, if you start pushing the eye well forwards and the eye slightly anterior, that's gonna shift myopic anyhow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting. My one of my favorite panels from my CATA coach session is your colleague in Pittsburgh, Deepi Dhaliwal, who's been amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So she's done interesting things like for kids who have a large group of anisometropic amblyopia, she does pediatric LASIK on that amblyopic eye.
I think first time I met Deep was in East Grinstead. Shiraz Dyer had a meeting probably in 2002, and she presented her pediatric LASIK group. People have moved away from LASIK in the really young ones because of the fear of ectasia, and they just go ahead and do PRK instead. And it still has a good outcome.
Yeah, or you can, even easier, you can do a fake guy well.
Yes.
And then in the future, swap it out.
Fake guy well. I mean, I have done clear lens extraction for real high unilateral high myopes. And right, that works very well too. You know, you gain vision. And you have to explain to parents that there's the risk, you know, retinal detachment because they're myopic. But even clear lens extraction is an option when they're myopic to the tune of over minus 15, you know?
Yeah, no, actually, the myopia is the ones easy. You got the pegging lenses because you can get those up to like minus 20-ish.
Yeah.
But I think even the high hyperopes and, yeah, there are a lot of options here. They're really, it's kind of neat to think a little bit differently, a little outside the box.
I think as long as you've tried conservative therapy and you're not getting anywhere, parents are willing to accept the risk so that there's some gain.
That's for sure. Yeah, one thing also,
the problem is that pediatric ophthalmologists by and large are very conservative, you know? So you'll see pediatric ophthalmologists sitting on these kids because they don't believe that it's worth the risk. And I believe the parents need to be given equipoise information. So you're not telling them that you want to do it. You're telling them these are the pros and cons and seeing if the parents want to do something.
Yeah, that makes the most sense for sure. You know, I was impressed that before my dad passed away last year, I had a thing where I had me, my son, and my father together. And I said, I want to just try one thing regarding retinal sensitivity. So we got our phone light. And I said, okay, you're going to hold it in front of the eye, look right at the light, really nice and bright, for 10 seconds, take it away, and then how fast before you can see again, before your retina recovers. And then my son, who was like 22 at the time, it's like a second. For me, at the time, 50-ish, it was like a few seconds. And for my dad, who at the time was like 85, it took like 20 seconds. So just to show you what a difference in just the retinal sensitivity, you know?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I'm sorry to hear that your dad passed away. My sympathies. But it's a great illustration, as you say, of retinal sensitivities through the generations.
Right. So I think that's why some of these teenage kids, like, they can do okay. If you're a 16, 18-year-old and you got bilateral cataracts for whatever bad reason and you're not amblyopic or anything, you can do pretty well, even if the lens is light splitting, a trifocal lens.
So there's one other thing talking about retinal sensitivity. Because we're a sort of quaternary referral center, we get children sent to us with all sorts of systemic conditions. If you ever have a child or an adult who you know has mitochondrial disorder, then operate on a low illumination. Operate on the lowest illumination that you can, because the oxidative stress can damage their visual pathway. So when I have children with mitochondrial disease or an optic nerve problem like OPA1, which is autosomal dominant optic atrophy, I operate on an illumination of 7 to 10%.
Wow. Yeah.
Very low, but it's very important.
Yeah, for those cases, we can even use the heads-up display.
Well, I think the heads-up display is much better. Unfortunately, it's been difficult for me to buy it at the children's hospital here, but I'm working on it.
Oh, yeah, because then you can put the light sensitivity, you can put the light really low and crank up the gain on the camera, and you can see perfectly fine.
You're absolutely right. That's what I did for one case, actually. We had, I can't remember who was bringing their instrument in, but we used their, and it was, I was right down to 7%, but I could see everything.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So yeah, I think this was very helpful discussion for me. A lot of our listeners in other countries, they don't have an expert like you in the community. So sometimes it falls in the ophthalmologist's hands. Like, listen, I mostly do adult cataracts, but okay, I know a little bit, and you've got to handle this.
Now, I think what I found is, as you know, I co-founded the World Society of Pediatric Ophthalmology and Strabismus with David Granite, and it's meant that I've traveled all over the world. And I say very clearly, the majority of children's eye care is done by adult ophthalmologists who are good enough to look after children, not by dedicated pediatric ophthalmologists globally. And I think by and far, by large, that they do a great, great, great job, really a great job. I do think sometimes we have to be careful. You know, just because you can do something doesn't mean that it should be done in a child. And you just have to be, just be careful. And but it's amazing how well people do for kids. It's amazing.
For sure. So patients presenting to you, again, this is very much below your level. This is a very basic question, so forgive that. But if a patient comes to see me, I see a pediatric patient, young child, unilateral cataract, I should always think of persistent fetal vasculature, for sure.
Well, if they're under one, for sure. As they get older, if it's unilateral, then the commonest cause is a posterior lenticonus. Sure. And posterior lenticonus, as you know, is a form of PFV. But those are the ones where, when you remove the lens matter, you really want to remove the periphery first, mm-hmm. and then the nucleus last, in case that...
it's weak.
Yeah, it's weak or it's busted.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it can be like an adult posterior polar where at the posterior lenticonus, it's already broken.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, before I came to America, I used to do adult cataract surgery in my private practice in London. And I remember seeing a chap who'd had surgery in one eye and the lens had dropped. And he'd got it had been done somewhere in another country. And he said that they told him that he had a congenital problem. So I'm looking and I can't see the posterior polar cataract, but that's what I'm thinking he's got. So what I did was I did my Rexis, and then I skewered the nucleus with a 30 gauge needle through the limbus. And then when I did my, my hydro delamination, not dissection, took the nucleus away, I could see that there was I had ruptured when I'd done my hydrodelamination, but the lens didn't fall because I had it skewered.
Oh, so sure.
I did the fake emulsification like a marshmallow, just turning the thing. And then I was able to suck out the lens material, and there was a hole. So I put the lens in the sulcus, but it was something that I learned in pediatric ophthalmology. Sometimes we get these subluxated lenses that are very wobbly. We just skewer them with two 30 gauge needles while we figure out what to do with the capsule and the thing so it doesn't fall down.
I've never tried that. I've got, if I have a case coming up, my practice is 99.9% adult, but if I have a case like that, let me try that.
Yeah. The other place that I once thought that I might have to do it was in a pseudo exfoliation adult, with the zonules a week. Yeah. And I had the nurse have the 30 gauge ready for me in case I thought the lens was about to drop, skewer it,
Just make sure you have, the longer 30 gauge.
Yes. Yes. The short one would be very embarrassing.
You won't quite get it at all. But, what an interesting way of doing this. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing your video about these pediatric cases. And I'm just so impressed about how much use you've gotten out of that intraoperative OCT.
Oh,
like you can image the posterior lenticonus. You can do all kinds of things.
Oh, no. I also, you can operate when you haven't got a view using the OCT. So I have a video where... I cut this stalk and I couldn't see it, but I was using the OCT to see the stalk to cut it. You know, it's a neat instrument. I'm not sure what I would do without it. I mean, I do D-sects now and in really opaque corneas and children, which I could never do before.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. But you're still using like the older adult tissue, right? You're not using a pediatric corneal tissue. DMEC tissue would be all wrinkled.
No, I'm using adult tissue. I try to use tissue that's under the age of 30 if I can get a hold of it. But I don't do DMECs in kids. I'm still doing D-sects. And what happens is that, again, we haven't published this yet, but we find that even if you use 120, 140 micron, after 6 weeks, it's thinned so much on the OCT. So there must be something about, and these are young children, right? I'm doing children under the age of 6. Must be something about their metabolism that they can remodel that so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we learned that. Kids are not just small adults. They're very different creatures.
Yeah, they are. They are. But I want to just say it is amazing, your channel, Cataract Coach. People learn so much from it. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was going to say that even on Cataract Coach years ago, I can put a link down below for our listeners. I had a case of a baby, unilateral leukocoria, sent to the county hospital where I'm with my residents. And you'll see this one-month-old baby, and you can't quite tell because it's hard to examine. So you go to the operating room, and when you do the exam under anesthesia, you're like, oh, there's a pupillary membrane there with a little gap.
Yeah.
So we do the OCT, and you can see that actually there's a normal lens capsule. There's a gap there. Yeah. So I end up using retina microscissors, cutting out the pupillary membrane, and there is a completely clear human crystalline lens. I was like, what a blessing.
Yeah, I did one on Monday.
Oh,
and what I do is I just use Helon to lift up the strands, and then as you lift up the strands, the plaque lifts.
Then
you just cut all the way around and you're done.
Yeah, and the amazing part was like a totally clear crystalline lens. And then even a year, 2 years later, still no cataract development. Like, whoa, got lucky there.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
It's so fun. You know what you could do is you've got all these great fellows. You have one of them start like a pediatric channel. Because I got Cataract Coach, which is everything cornea, cataract, glaucoma, refractive. I have retina around. There's anything posterior segment. I don't have anything pediatric. That's what you guys should start.
You know what? I'm gonna reach out to you. I'm going to be in LA for ASCRS. Are you there?
Of course.
Okay. Well, let's spend a half an hour making sure that we're sampling the best drinks.
Absolutely.
And you can tell me how to start this channel. I would love to do it.
Yeah, I think you'd do great. You've got like such an incredible talent there in your whole department.
We have.
And you've got cases that are just, it would be an incredible learning library.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's time to do that.
All right, we got the right person. I love it. Well, Ken, I want to thank you for doing our podcast. Can you believe we've been talking for almost an hour? How time flies.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you give me my pleasure. You are a sweetheart. Like, if what I see, all I'm going to do is give you a bear hug.
Oh, we're on. Juppy. Hug in Punjabi.
I love it. I mean, we had just such a great time together. I really connected with you when we were in London. And even like my personal life, which I won't discuss here, but you gave me such great sage advice. And like, man, you're like the big brother I never had. I love it.
That's wonderful. That's the best thing you could have said to me. Thank you.
For sure. So after this, we'll put any links you give me down below, like your website or whatever else. And also, please send me the beautiful video, and we'll feature that the day after your podcast.
All right.
And then I'll see you in Los Angeles.
I think it's in 10 days or something.
In about a week,
I'll send you the videos at the weekend.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. God bless.
I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, we already have now a Retina Rounds podcast every Sunday as well. And of course, every day there's a new Cataract Coach video. We're almost at 2,600 videos and a new one every day. And Retina Rounds, we still also have a new video every day. We're coming on case number 100 for them. So until next time, I'll catch you later.